welcome to this episode of Real Geeks, where, just quick side note right off the bat, you may have recalled from our Promising Young Woman review that we pretty much rushed through it because Crash joined us despite a severe migraine. Well, now it's everyone else's turn. And in this case, this is almost extra ironic because
the things that we do for our people.
Exactly. Especially with this episode, because call us Ishmael. This review is basically our white whale. Now
I'm so sorry. I am so sorry.
Now, for those of you who've been with us for a while, and we love all two of you, as you may recall from past episodes, we've covered one of Crash's favorite movies with The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. We've covered one of my favorite movies with 1994's The Shadow. But you may have noticed we haven't done Vita's favorite movie.
We have.
Here's the thing.
Repeatedly.
We have tried to do Vita's favorite movie a now record five times.
Oh, my fault.
We have, honest to God, been trying to review the 1984 film Dreamscape since late last year. And by the time you're seeing this, it's probably early to mid-spring. But so help me, this is going to goddamn work.
You say that. And yet.
Oh,
hence why we didn't reschedule today.
Proven a fool.
Not only do I say that, but I have taken steps as insurance. I have my lucky 50-cent piece here that I'm pretty sure is actually only lucky because it ended up in my piece of birthday cake instead of my mother's, and she was not happy about it. I have an evil eye ward that is meant to block, like, bad luck, bad fortune, negativity, and all that, hanging on my door that I bought specifically for this review. And all right, well, it's not going to come off, but I have a second one hanging on the side of my Mac. Because, again, I don't care what I have to do. This episode is going to fucking work. Share this review with your friends. You can share it with our friends.
Are
too.
We
what
keeping that in there?
And, of course, realgeeks.redbubble.com, where we have merch. Please go buy it because we need money for better quality than this. So the 1984's Dreamscape stars Dennis Quaid doing his Han Solo auditions about 6 years too late. Like, let's be honest, 84 Dennis Quaid looks like Ansel Elgort and sounds like young Harrison Ford. So it's pretty clear that, so help him, one way or the other, he was going to play Han Solo no matter what he had to do.
Yeah, now he's early 80s, early to mid 80s, generic action leading man.
Doesn't the cover of the movie actually resemble Raiders of the Lost Ark? I'm trying to remember.
Oh, no, actually, I have it's on the IMDb entry right here, and it absolutely does for no real reason beyond the simple fact that it's Drew Struzan art, who I believe also did the poster art for Raiders of the Lost Ark. And make no mistake, over the course of this episode, we are probably going to be connecting this movie to an awful lot of other early 80s films and other properties. In fact, we actually
may at that point in time, it was basically hero, heroine, insert new storyline. So,
I mean,
there was a very strict formula of movies in the 80s.
I mean, it's pretty much that. There's also the simple fact that the film also stars 1984 Kate Capshaw, who, when you say 1984 Kate Capshaw movie where someone gets their heart ripped out of their chest, this is probably not the movie most people are going to think of. But, so Dreamscape, like we said, stars Dennis Quaid as Alex Gardner, a psychic who we meet at the racetrack gambling, because let's be honest, it's a rule of film that if you're introducing a psychic character, they're somewhere gambling. I don't know if this is a movie that started that rule, but that's just how it works.
No, that's the general perception of those that have gifts, is that they're using them for personal or monetary gain, which in the real world, that's not how it works. But, you know, I'm not the one writing the movie, so.
No, exactly. And there's a point later on where they do set up a blatant, oh, the psychic didn't see that coming joke, yet they don't do it. Which is, like, understandable, but at the same time, a little disappointing. And we also have Max von Sydow as Paul Novotny, the head of a project at a university that is analyzing people's dreams and developing a process for psychics to enter people's dreams, because, I mean, again, it was the early 80s. That's just how film worked.
Well, because, like, this is coming just a few years after the revelation of MKUltra. So it was very much in the public consciousness that these kinds of studies existed, and all anyone wanted to do was dig into it in fiction, because what a ridiculous concept. Let's go full hog. Let's make Firestarter. Let's make, you know, it obviously influenced Dream Warriors. It was a whole thing for a while.
Oh, God, was it ever. Like, it's, again, it's one of those, you could almost track historic cinema just by picking out one theme in a movie that particular year, and you could safely assume there's at least six other films that are doing basically the same thing. Because also, again, with this being an roughly early 80s film, the Cold War features in the story, because of course it does. And this is where we get Christopher Plummer as Bob Blair, the head of the nameless government shadow agency that was basically the CIA at a point where you weren't necessarily allowed to use the name CIA in film.
Well, technically it is mentioned, but apparently Bob Blair's not part of the CIA. He's okay. Part of another secretive government-run agency that, you know, is ever-present in the 80s.
I mean, like, even then, I'm still kind of going, yeah, writers, we know what you meant. I'm cool with you doing this, but we know what you meant. And
of course, they're always pulling strings in the political world.
Oh, yeah. And of course, again, with the standard rules of 80s film, if you want a professor / father figure with a slight accent, you get Max von Sydow.
Yeah.
Again, that's just how it works.
Very specifically, slight accent looks creepy, but is not intimidating.
Yeah.
he comes off more grandfatherly and odd. If he does a villain turn, it's very surprising and shocking. He is unlike, you know, some other actors who are incapable of doing hero or positive, you know, like characters. Jeremy Irons is a great villain. Don't let him be anything but a villain.
No, he can only be a villain, never a hero, never a butler. I mean, and again, with the late, great Christopher Plummer, you could pretty much just drop him into any role, and he's Christopher Plummer. I think here it may take a few viewings to truly appreciate his work in this film. But I think the more you watch it, the scarier Plummer's character gets, because just because of how calm he is throughout the entire damn movie, no matter what is actually happening.
Yeah, no, he reminds me
of Gus Spring. Oh, he's calm, he's cordial, he's courteous.
Yeah.
And it's not until about halfway through the movie that he decides to throw away all pretense and show that he's a real shit.
Oh, but like, even then, he's still just as calm and no, this is how it works. There's just nothing you can really do here.
Yeah. Yeah, I've already won because you're like, I did.
Yep.
That happened. Deal with it.
And then, of course, going further down the cast list, we have David Patrick Kelly as Tommy Ray Glattman, who you may not know the name David Patrick Kelly.
But you should.
You not only should. I promise you, you have seen the man, and as soon as I say Commando or The Crow
or
The Warriors,
there you go.
like I said, he's not necessarily a household name, but he's also responsible for some of the most well-known and probably most often quoted dialogue in the history of cult film. And finally, we come to Corey Yothers as Buddy Driscoll, who, side note, Corey Yothers has what is now my new all-time favorite trivia entry on IMDb, because speaking of connections to other properties, we can connect this film to Family Ties of all things. Okay. Because he is the brother of Tina Yothers, and IMDb lists him as the brother of Tina Yothers and Poindexter Yothers. And the fact that someone's parents named their child Poindexter is just a special kind of amazing to me.
Did they expect the kid to get beat up in school?
Right?
Why?
I don't know.
Why put that on your child?
I half expect to find out that this kid's poor kid's middle name is actually Beat Me Up. When we first meet Novotny and Bob Blair, they're in a amphitheater discussing their dream project, and Novotny is introducing Alex and talking about how they need him for this project to work, and we're shown a film demonstrating Gardner's connection with Novotny, where he specifically refers to him as 19-year-old Alex Gardner. And
he's very mature. It's okay. He's just, listen, kids in the past had harder lives. They started smoking when they were 9. and Horn when they were 10.
Now, this
but is I also... mean, he's talking about this guy that he worked with 9-10 years ago, who was like 19 at the time. So typical college student who, you know, in 10 years hasn't grown up any.
Oh, clearly in many, many ways. It's one of those beautiful things about 80s, both film and TV, where the 19-year-old is obviously actually in his early 30s. And it's one of the many elements of this film that's either wonderfully done or it's just glorious.
Gee, what choices you've given us. Wonderful or glorious? Yeah.
Blair basically says, "Oh, don't worry about trying to find Alex. Leave that to me, because, again, he's an 80s spy master, so he can instantly find anyone." And after a beautiful chase sequence at a horse racing track where Alex has to elude what's basically the local Irish mafia in a lovely little sequence where I loved how they took the horse race announcer and put his dialogue on top of the actual chase sequence, and it syncs up so nicely.
Yeah, it's a weird film where there's tiny moments of inspiration, and it's like, you had an idea with this. You planned this out. This may have been even an early scene that you thought unrelated to this movie. And it's really curious how, like, there is a complete film here. It's good.
Yeah.
I enjoy it. I've had to watch it enough fucking times. But... There's weird little patchwork moments in it, such as we'll get to later with this just beautiful green screen effect. It's not like repeated again. There's just these odd segments.
And so before we get to the green screen, Alex makes it back to his apartment, and we find out he's kind of in the 80s, not scumbag, but he's the generic 80s, not necessarily a good guy. And
scumbag is a pretty good word.
Yeah. Fair enough. I was sitting here, it's like, I don't know if I quite want to go with scumbag, but it's all I can think of.
Nah, he's a scumbag.
The impression is that, again, it's a college student that never grew up. So he's approaching 30, he's still dating, and he's more than likely using his gift to get him laid. That's where that goes.
Oh, no, No, that's clearly exactly what he's doing, because what I wanted to highlight here was the sequence with the answering machine. Which I love how at one point he gets a message from his ex-girlfriend who the first message is the standard, "Alex, I hate you. I don't ever want to see you again. Don't contact me." And the very next message is the same woman going, "Hey, Alex, what? When are you call me sometime?" Like, that's just one of the most hilariously quick flip flops I have ever seen. And so when Alex leaves his apartment, he gets down the street, and this wood paneled station wagon pulls up because. Again, early 80s film involving anything psychic or psychology related, you need that station wagon.
Yeah, it's both a great family sedan and discreet government conspiracy vehicle.
Oh, exactly. And it's driven by Blair's...
They get up to pull the body.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And it's driven by Blair's two agents who, over the course of this movie, I was half convinced may have been the only two agents he actually had, who were Babcock and Finch, or as I've referred to them every time I've seen this film, Almost Lee Majors and Oh That Guy.
Oh, it's that guy.
Because Peter Jason, especially in this film, I'm sorry, he looks like early to mid-80s Lee Majors. And Chris Mulkey is one of those character actors where, again, you don't know the name necessarily, but you've seen that face somewhere. And as much as Peter Jason in particular, he doesn't do a whole lot over the course of the film. He's pulling a Christopher Plummer over the course of the drive from the apartment to the university, because he's so calmly telling Alex, yeah, you're coming with us whether you want to or not. And he's just like, well, yeah, you're not in danger from us. As soon as you get out of this car, you might be utterly fucked, but... So, then of course, Alex is initially refusing to cooperate at all, because everything that we've learned about him over the course of the movie up to this point just blatantly screams, no, there's no way he's going on with this. And then... Novotny basically goes, well, that's too bad you don't want to cooperate with us, because I heard you had a bit of a problem with the IRS coming up. And I guess they're looking
at... Or, you know, if you don't help us, you will have a problem with the IRS.
I guess they've been looking at all your finances and all your gambling, and they're considering a 5-year audit. Whoa. Which, as I mentioned earlier, somehow the psychic didn't see that coming. And that's actually a plot point that oddly gets dropped at pretty much at that moment, because there is another confrontation later on where Novotny could have pulled that card out again, but doesn't.
Well, no, because now he's a willing participant.
Well, he is, except for one thing that, yeah, willing in quotes because of one element that we'll get to in a bit, but Alex has his first test drive, so to speak, dream walk, where we get to the visual effects in this film, and the visual effects that should not work,
and yes, beautiful,
and yet so perfectly glorious. I mean, like, this movie is, of course, nearly 40 years old, so, of course, visually, everything is just as out of date as can be, but where all the effects are confined to the dream sequences, so looking out of date is not exactly a problem.
Yeah, it actually just becomes more stylized with time. It's fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
Completely accidental, I'm sure, in those terms, but very well done.
Oh yeah,
terrible.
I think too, if they had strived for authenticity, if they had strived for looking like every other day normalcy in the dream sequences, it would have been plain and boring.
Oh no, it absolutely
and it wouldn't have aged well as it does. I mean, there are a couple of parts in the movie that didn't age very well, and that would be the train sequence. But the rest all of the dreams that are in there, you could put them in any decade, and because of the way that they're done, they still work.
Oh yeah, and it's like, especially where each sequence has almost its own unique group of effects. Even with the repeated use of rear projection and blue screen and so forth, they're all done differently in just little ways to make each dream its own unique thing. And particularly when we come to one of the dream sequences with Mr. Weber, who's there because one of the things that they also study in this program is dreams and sexual dysfunction, because of course we have to have that comedy dream sequence, and where this one is so completely different from every other sequence because it's shot with just this fisheye lens that it's like they just, for each sequence, they just said to the camera crew, y'all have fun.
Yeah, give us something unique that could be interpreted as a dream. And the fisheye lens is such a terrific choice for this because it makes everything feel confrontational. Just like the character that we are diving into is constantly in a state of paranoia and fear sexually.
Insecurity, yeah.
And also with that sequence, the actor who's playing the Asian gardener, who, for a guy who has no lines and about 4 seconds of screen time, he may also have the greatest tee-hee expression I have ever seen on film.
Yeah, no, that's a expression that tells a body tale.
I almost wish that they had dropped a few more of the other extras in that scene so that we could have more of him. Because he's just, as one of the guys, this guy thinks his wife is having an affair with, because this guy is basically every stereotypical balding insecure male you have ever thought of.
Terrible toupee.
With a terrible unsecured toupee, because the simple fact that even in his own dream, the thing falls off.
He's very insecure.
But like I said, I just wish you had more of the Asian gardener.
Insecure, unsecure, you know.
Like that, the Asian gardener specifically, he's one of those, I should hate you, but you're kind of adorable, so I can't. And then finally we come to the big kind of the B plot dream sequences, specifically with little Buddy Driscoll, who I almost wish that the movie was focused more on him. Because there's just so much wonderful 80s effects work in his dreams. For one thing, after we have what might be the best use of an M.C. Escher staircase outside of Labyrinth. And this kid is being, and this is part of the reason that I wish they'd focus more on him, because I said for some unknown reason, he's being haunted by this mysterious snake man.
Yeah, Lord knows what that means.
Yeah, that I wish that had been expanded on more. Because there's
totally, I mean, we all know that, you know, the snake monster represents something in Buddy's life, We don't know what it is. And that's, I think, the biggest sticking point with me for this whole movie, even more so what's going on in Buddy's life, that he feels the need to have it represented by this big, scary monster that's taking over his waking world, his sleeping world. Like, what's causing it? And that even the part where, you know, they run past his father and, oh, that's my dad, he won't help us. And the dad says, yeah, the little bastard's right. And then the snake eats the bad dad. So I would love to know more about what's going on in his life to have that kind of influence on his dreams.
Exactly. I think when you that sequence first starts, you would think that the Snake Man was representative of like an abusive parent or something. And then when we go to the dad, and right after that, you hear the Snake Man eating the dad. And it's like, well, the Snake Man is clearly something worse. But what is it?
Yeah, if they had just, it would have taken a little more patience as a filmmaker, but if they had hung that as the A plot, or at least the first act to get everyone going and everyone involved, and then slid the actual plot in later, that would have really served it by, frankly, making it a more serious film.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, instead of it just being incidental.
Exactly. Like the other plot line is the early 80s standard almost of the president is having nightmares because he has this major decision coming up where he's leading a diplomatic team to Russia to sign a disarmament pact. And I get the simple fact that it's an early 80s film. So if you're going to do anything that's even remotely a political thriller, the Cold War is, of course, going to feature prominently.
Oh, yes.
But at the same time, I kind of wish that had been dropped simply because I think you could almost take that out, develop the storyline with Buddy, and I would say at least 90% of the elements in this film would probably still work just fine.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it is definitely just there to generate a sense of urgency. I think you're absolutely right. You could simply just scrap that entire plot line and have it just be like, control of this power and this young child and what this means, and why it matters to the government, why it matters to this university, why it matters personally to our hero.
Unless anybody has anything else, we can go into ratings.
Let's rate this bitch.
For me, I think I said 4 out of 5 in our past recordings, which I'm going to stick with for this one, because as much as there are like a lot of tiny, wait, what? Moments, they're the kind of moments that you have to expect in a film from this era. But there's a lot here that really does work, and my only real major objection is that I wish the story had been just that little bit tighter. Vita, how about you?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I mean, I saw this movie within a year or two of its release date. I don't know if it was a rented VHS or a turned into TV movie. But there are so many scenes, there are so many parts of it that stayed with me. I know that at that age, I was already learning about telepathy, telekinesis, that sort of thing, intuitive abilities. So a lot of what happened in this movie formed the basis for my ethics and my morals regarding psychic ability and dealing with people while using them. The movie itself, I mean, for it to have stayed with me for 30 plus years,
yeah,
goes to show that it had such an impact, especially in quote unquote formative times. I remember more about this movie than I did about Nightmare on Elm Street, and I saw them around the same time frame. Even though I've seen Nightmare on Elm Street more than I had seen Dreamscape this last year, not to be mentioned. I would put it easily a 4 out of 5. I enjoyed the sticking issues that didn't age well, notwithstanding. I enjoyed the movie then. I still enjoy the movie. The writing, yes, there are some spots where it would have been better to have them knit just a little bit more, just something there. I love the dream sequences. I love them. I cannot say enough how much I love the dream sequences. I enjoy Dennis Quaid as Alex. I enjoy Novotny, Max von Sydow as Novotny. Gene, I could have done with something. She's not one of my main focuses in the movie. But everything yeah. else that was there, Buddy, Tommy Ray, I loved all of the characters. And let's see, in the last, we've been trying to do this review since when? This is our fifth time doing.
Yep.
So this is like, just for real geeks alone, I've watched this movie 6 times. Because there was the time that I watched it and then we had to reschedule the review because we couldn't do it that day. So I still don't hate this movie, even though I've watched it 6 times for real geeks. So right there, that's saying a lot. But yeah, I would put it at 4 or 5, totally.
And Crash?
Yeah, I'm going to give it 4 failed reviews out of 5 attempts.
No matter how, that's perfect. Like,
you said it. No matter how many times I watch it, and no matter how like over it I get, it's still an enjoyable film. It's still a very good cheesy 80s flick. And I suggest that you watch it possibly as much as we've had to.
that was beautiful.
And now it's done. It's done.
Please.
Don't jinx it.
This is going to work, damn it. with that, once again, don't forget those like and subscribe buttons. Like, I'm sorry, just for this review finally actually working, we deserve some likes, damn it. realgeeks.redbubble.com for some of our lovely merchandise here. And coming up next will be, I mentioned the idea earlier of a theme of doing a David Patrick Kelly movies. And coming up, we'll be experimenting with that idea with our first themed series of a 2-part Pick Your Poison. Featuring first 1990s Darkman, where in addition to rating the film, we have to pick between this film and the film that almost happened instead. So until then, Vita, anything going on outside of this?
I mean, you know, there's all kinds going on outside of this. There's work, there's sleep, there's no shows. There's just me trying to make product and trying to get it on my website and trying to find sleep and trying to figure out what happened to that clone that I ordered a couple of years ago, because I think it's still on back order or it got lost or something. But
well, did you order it off of Wish? Because that might be the problem.
No, it may have been Amazon. It may have been Amazon. I'm not sure. It's been a while. Yeah.
Well, next up, Crash, how about you?
Posting stuff to patreon.com/herego. I wrote in a book. It's called Curtains. Check it out. There's a link on the site. And I'm now the editor for Rolled Up Podcast. So check out Pit Stop and Rolled Up, available wherever podcasts are. Oh, and we have launched the Real Geeks podcast, which takes all the classic episodes of Real Geeks and puts them into a podcast. So you can listen to Mike for 85 episodes.
It was really 85? Because I know I'm not in all of them, so it might have been like 83?
Okay, fine. 83 episodes. Jesus. I've been loading them very slowly, and we've got about, I'm 3 months in with 2 to 3 episodes a week.
Oh, Jesus.
Take a while.
Yeah, this is what we get for
disturbing. I think that's the definition of a labor of love.
For money.
Yeah, Lord, no. Oh, this is what happens when we start doing audio episodes 3 years after the video.
Yeah. But hey, that's